On a sunny Saturday afternoon in the not-too-distant past, I paid a visit to the very fancy Raphael Hotel on the plaza. Out front, valets stepped into visitors' cars, and the patio was bustling. A chipper crowd had gathered around small tables on the terrace. Smiling servers whisked around carrying specialty cocktails and delicate hors d'oeuvres. And so it's against this unlikely backdrop that a cowboy band was playing on a little patch of grass. Guys in boots and what I'm calling neckerchiefs singing four-part harmonies. That band is Three Trails West, and they're some of the only practitioners of true cowboy music in Kansas City. They were named the 2016 Band of the Year by the Academy of Western Artists and the Western Music Association. But here in the city, they're not too well known. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm pleased to welcome some of the cowboys from Three Trails West to KCUR's Central Standard. Leo Iltz, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. And Roger Iltz, good morning to you, too.
Good morning, and a cowboy howdy.
How do you define cowboy music?
Well, it's a lot different than what people call country western. Cowboy music is pretty much western music. It has its origins in the 30s, and it's the sort of music you'd hear in the old westerns, the Roy Rogers and Gene Autry western shows. So it's got, there's very little percussion, generally no drums, and it's done with all acoustic instruments.
What else do we need to know about the history, Roger?
It's Americana. It's about doing the right thing, your word.
The right thing.
Uh-huh.
The cowboy way.
The cowboy way. It's your word is your honor.
Tell me when you say the cowboy way, where does that phrase come from? What does that mean?
Well, what it means to me is that if you say that you're going to do something, you do it. If you borrow money, you pay it back. If you owe money, you pay your debts. You put in a good hard day's work for fair wages. That's what cowboys did.
That's what they did factually?
Yeah, factually.
Yeah, I think so. That's a fair statement, yes. Factually, the Western gentleman, the Western way, the cowboy way, was about honor. And yeah, most of the people I know that are involved in ranching business and the music business that we play in, yeah, they're like that.
I was doing some reading about cowboy music, and there was this like catalog of cowboy music published in 1939. Mm-hmm. In a Kansas history journal. So a history journal from what we would now call history. And this person who was writing about the music had heard it firsthand. This was written in 1939, and she wrote, this is a very recent history. And that you would think, because of that, that you would know who wrote the songs or who first sang a song. And that even in 1939, that was not the case. How did these songs get taught and popularized?
Well, the popular fiction is not necessarily fiction. The cowboy way of life is kind of lonely, and these guys spend a lot of time alone. So a lot of these songs were written by cowboys who were out taking care of cattle and working on ranches. And a lot of them exist in popular culture without authorship, because they've just been passed around so often that nobody knows really where the song started.
There is a lot. Of course, these guys were immigrants, so they were from Ireland and Germany and all over. And so you will hear remnants of folk tunes and those type of things in some of the songs. Some of them are directly related to that. They'll take a tune and put cowboy words to it.
And these cowboys were also from places like Mexico. And I mean, it's a really interesting kind of international history, for as much as we call it Americana.
Well, what we think about of the modern cowboy, actually, they started out as the Mexican vaqueros. And so that's where your great cattle guys came from. And, of course, we exported a few of them to Hawaii, for instance. A bunch of American cowboys went to Hawaii and helped them get the cattle business started back over there in the 30s.
Does it feel funny to perform cowboy music on the country club plaza or plaza, depending on who you may be?
We'll take our gigs wherever we can find them.
But I mean, the backdrop of your lives is not a cowboy backdrop.
Well,
not now.
Kansas City, right. I should say, first of all, that Kansas City is kind of in denial of its cowtown heritage.
Tell me more.
Well, it's something I've experienced in the 40 years I've been living in Kansas City, because Kansas City, if you went to the East Coast or the West Coast, everybody thought Kansas City was kind of a hick town. And people were that lived locally and did business locally were not necessarily proud of that. They didn't want to be known as a cow town. They wanted to be known as a modern business-oriented city. So even though Kansas City's place in history is built on the cattle business, the railheads that were established here and everything. So yeah, it's Kansas City's been a little slow to embrace its roots, I think.
It's also interesting for us as part of this Western Music Association and the cowboy music. We often say we are pretty much the easternmost influence of that group, because it really starts on the West Coast. When you look at cowboy music per se, you know, when it started. So it was big because a lot of these groups had radio shows and those type of things. So the further west we go, the more popular we are, you know, the more people know about us. But we're trying to draw people into it because we think it's a fantastic cultural heritage.
You're both sitting here in, you know, cowboy button downs with the sort of pearly snap buttons. Mm-hmm. And what did you call your scarf thingies?
Well, mine, they actually call an Apache scarf. I don't know where that came from, but if you go into a Western store and ask for an Apache scarf, this is what they'll get. It's a smaller than the large scarf that Leo has.
This one is actually what you consider kind of a dress scarf, and it's tied in what's called a buckaroo knot.
Yeah, low and loose, kind of?
Yeah, low and loose and very kind of flowing.
They're both turquoise and shiny.
Mm-hmm.
Shiny's important.
Shiny.
And Leo, you have a twirly mustache.
Yes, I do. Handlebars, yeah.
So I think it's fair to say, and there are hats set up next to both of you. They've had to come off of your heads because of the headphones.
Yeah. That's true.
Would you say there's a bit of a shtick here?
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
If you compared our apparel to real cowboys, big difference. I've done a little research, and Buffalo Bill Cody, when he started his big Western show.
When is this? What vintage are we talking?
That would have been in the 40s.
Early 40s, maybe.
Yeah, early 40s, maybe late 30s. And he had a lot to do with creating this image of the cowboy, because the cowboys, they were workers, they were ranch hands. And so, you know, they wore dungarees, and, you know, and their clothes were very utilitarian. You know, the hats were for a reason.
The chaps, the boots.
But what he did is he made sure that his actors bathed regularly and cleaned up and dressed nicely. And it was actually a very good thing for the image of the American cowboy.
Speaking of, you know, cleanliness and so forth, some of your banter is pretty funny. Like, there was at the show, there was something about worshiping, and you were talking yeah. about you used to think it was "Where I Wash Up."
Well, it's actually a gospel tune.
It's called "The Place Where I Worship Is the Wide Open Spaces."
And we make the joke that Roger got the title wrong originally. He thought it was about cleanliness and hygiene, and the song was "The Place Where I Worship."
And is that true? Did you really think that at some point?
No, it's a shtick.
But every cowboy knows that you wash up upstream from the herd.
That's true.
But tell me about the significance of shtick, because it seems like the true history of the cowboy is important to you. But it also seems like there is this cowboy type that you're also kind of enamored with and playing with.
When in our introduction, we say that we are Three Trails West from Kansas City, singing songs of the silver screen, the Great West, and the Great American Cowboy. And so really what we're about is the silver screen cowboy, what Roy Rogers made famous, and Gene Autry, and those type of groups, Sons of the Pioneers. And that's the fancy shirts. That's where that all came from.
Why is that piece of it important? We've heard a little bit about why the actual cowboy and the actual cowboy music is important, but why is the cowboy we've seen on the silver screen important?
Because of the image. Basically, we have a thing. When we play, we are dressed like this. I mean, we come from bluegrass as well. We did a lot of bluegrass over the years, and I think a mistake a lot of bands make is they forget that they are on stage and they should look better. They should be dressed better than the audience, and that doesn't happen a lot. In our case, we know our audience, we know our crowd, and we dress it, we look it, and the humor can be a little corny, but it works.
It's a big thing in this genre that it is a family-oriented type of music. I would take it a step further. The image is important, but where those movies and all, that's where the music came from. And when you listen to some of the groups, it's really incredible, the musicianship. This is some of the hardest music I've ever played.
Yeah, it's not easy.
But when you look at it, the reason is this, and actually our steel player, Bill Dye, called this to my attention. He said, look, he said, when this music started and got hot, it was during the Depression. And so there were a lot of, like, symphony musicians. Classically trained musicians in the East Coast that were looking for work. And so they moved to the West Coast and played cowboy music. It's really, some of the recordings are incredible.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
I want to play one of your songs. It's called The West Is As Wild As Ever. Tell me about this song.
It's one of our favorite groups, Andy Parker and the Plainsmen. They were contemporaries of the Sons of the Pioneers, but the Sons had the movie contract, so they were more well-known. This song, we joke about it, and we say if we had to do one cowboy song, this would be it, because every cowboy term you can imagine is in this song, and there's a lot of words. But it's really difficult, but really a fun tune, and very unique in the songs we do.
Let's give it a listen, and then we'll talk about it a little more, okay?
Great.
Yeah, great.
The legend of a nation, it's a rugged situation, 'cause the West is as wild as ever. Shaggy chefs with squeaky saddles, desert dust and alkali, riverbeds all parched and dry, rattlesnakes are lying, dreaming where the old bald eagle's screaming. Still I want to roam forever, where the West is as wild as ever.
So the four-part harmonies really jump out to me. And this is something that seems to transcend cultures, the sort of folkloric music with male harmony.
Absolutely. We have a big history. I'll go back to the bluegrass thing again. I'll go back to the barbershop, because you'll hear a lot of barbershop influence in these cowboy harmonies. Of course, barbershop predates the cowboy music as we know it. But yeah, male voices harmony. Well, think about The Boys on the Street. You know, that's a barbershop song. We were rough and ready guys, but oh, how we could harmonize. Yeah, it's the we're all baritones for one thing, and that gives us an opportunity to get those dense sounding harmonies packed together like that.
And again, the harmonies are very difficult, and our group basically consists of a vocal trio and an instrumental trio, and so the vocal trio will work endless hours on these tunes, and we'll take a phrase, you know, maybe two bars, and work it over and over again to make sure those intervals are perfect.
So, you know, it's interesting to me that historically this is a kind of music that originated with lonesome men on the range and has evolved into something with harmony, which would imply more than one person.
Yes, because that was the social aspect. These songs may have been composed in solitude, but they were performed in groups. And at the rodeos, or the rodeos, depending on how you want to pronounce it, the cattle drives, when they'd have the big parties, when they'd reach the trailhead, there was a big social aspect to this. And so these guys would get together, and yes, sir, they would sing.
Let's hear a little song called Swing Me Back to Texas.
Oh, yeah, this is a good one.
Mm-hmm. I've been riding the range on these Montana plains for so long. Just the sagebrush and coyotes to
Who's singing on that one?
That's our lead singer, Jim Winters.
Gentleman Jim.
Yeah. Jim has been performing old country music in the area for probably over 40 years. And so he became part of our group about four years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And just really launched us up a platform.
This song is very swingy.
Yeah, this was written by a friend of mine in Austin, Texas. And I was down visiting him a few years ago and told him we were looking for some original music to put on an album. He had actually written this song for Brother Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel, and for whatever reason they didn't pick it up. So he offered it to us, and we went after it. And so that's what their song came from.
Roger and Leo Iltz with Three Trails West. We are going to pick right back up with this conversation after a short break, okay?
You got it.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, Central Standard. We'll be right back.
Please don't bury me out on that lone prairie, 'cause Lord, I can't wait.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm sitting here with two of the musicians in Three Trails West, a country band. Not a country band.
Close.
A cowboy band.
Thank you.
Cowboy or Western, named 2016 Band of the Year by the Academy of Western Artists and the Western Music Association. Here in the city, they're not too well known.
Yet.
And as you can hear, they make a very big distinction between country and Western.
Absolutely.
The musicians sitting here with me right now are Roger and Leo Iltz. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So what are your day jobs when you're not cowboys? What are you?
I am recently retired from a company that I started in the 80s, and I was a litigation support specialist.
I'm in the food business, and we are manufacturers' representatives for different companies that sell in the food service business.
So you're not leading cattle across the range?
Nope.
We did have horses, and we're in a saddle club as kids.
But, we even delivered our newspaper route on horseback.
Yeah, I want to hear about your background. Do you have the same last name?
Yes. We were born in central Kansas.
Well, we thought we were in western Kansas, but once we left and traveled a little bit, we found out that there were things west of us in Kansas. And
we just didn't know about them.
Yeah.
So tell me about your upbringing. Where exactly in central Kansas were you?
We grew up in a little town called Rush Center, Kansas, which is about 30 miles south of Hayes. A lot of people know where Hayes is. And there are two paved roads in that town, and that's Highway 96 and Highway 183.
And if you got on 96 and kept going west, you'd end up in Colorado Springs. If you got on 183 and headed south, you'd end up in Austin. So we were at those crossroads.
What was your family like? What was daily life like for you guys as kids?
Well, our working parents, of course. Our father was a truck driver, over-the-road truck driver, and a farmer. And our mother was actually our music teacher when we were in grammar school. And she would play in the polka bands on Friday and Saturday nights, and she was the church organist on Sunday morning.
Sometimes without sleeping.
That's right. There was sometimes no sleep time in between the polka gig and the church organ thing.
So did she teach you to harmonize when you were young?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting story. When we would travel, we would sing in the car. And I guess it kept us from fighting. But so we would sing, and then Mom would sing a harmony part. And then eventually one of us would pick up that harmony part, and then she'd do another harmony part, and so we learned it just kind of by, you know, being immersed
just
in it.
Osmosis, we just heard it, and in fact, to this day, Roger and I don't consider ourselves, we don't sing lead much. We are, you know, like, what, Elvis had the Jordanaires for a backup band, you know?
Yeah, so we're the ultimate backup band, because we have rhythm guitar, bass, and vocals. So we thought maybe the Derrieres would
be Derrieres.
But you, when you were kids and learning to harmonize, this is part of a polka band you were in?
Well, Mom played the polka. But the music we grew up, I mean, by the time I was a young teenager, folk music was very popular. Peter, Paul, and Mary, and the different folk artists. And so I grew up listening to a lot of folk music and playing that. That was my first time out to start playing my own music. Then gradually, Roger went to college and got a degree in the performing arts.
Right. It's from Bethany College in Lindsborg, Kansas, and I got a vocal music performance degree, which a lot of people say it's kind of a would you like fries with that degree, but I learned a lot. And I tell you, actually, we had this discussion the other night. I was in a 72-voice choir that every person would say hosts at the same time. We had an incredible conductor. And that's where I learned a lot about arranging and the fineries of recording and performing.
So when I want to get back to your childhood in particular. I mean, you were growing up in central Kansas and you believed that it was western Kansas, which you're laughing, but I think that's interesting.
Well, the joke is that western Kansas is any place west of where you are in Kansas. So if you're like, maybe you're in Wyandotte County, Lawrence could be western Kansas.
That's true.
You know, or
if you're in Lawrence, Topeka could be western
could
Kansas.
Could be western Kansas. But it was very rural. And as a matter of fact, the town we lived in had less than 300 people in it. But musically, Mom did encourage us, and we focused on the Sons of the Pioneers. That was the music we loved. So there was a Gibson store about 25, 30 miles east of where we grew up in Great Bend, Kansas, and they had a little record department in the back. And on those rare occasions we went to Great Bend, Roger and I would make a beeline back to the record department, and for $3 or $2.50, you could buy, you know, we bought every Sons of the Pioneers album we could find. And so at night, we had a stack of them. And we had one of these old turntable type things. We put the whole stack on there, and we turned the speakers so they went into the vents, so they play in our room. And we go to bed listening to that music every night. And the next night, we take the whole stack and flip it over and do the same thing the next night.
What did the idea of the cowboy mean to you at that point, growing up in this farming community in central Kansas?
So if you listen to the words, you know, it sings about the moonlight on the prairie and the blues and the greens at night and the canyons. Of course, we didn't have canyons, but, you know, you could go outside at night with a full moon and you're immersed in the lyrics of these songs. We also had horses. We were the last house before the city limits. And so we had a pasture and we had horses and we'd go out at night and ride sometimes, you know.
Bareback.
Yeah. And so that was kind of, that's as much as being a cowboy as we got to be. And we loved it.
You know, there's a line that comes up in these songs sometimes, and I don't know the history of this line. I'm maybe as far from an expert as you could be, but the line about not being buried on the prairie.
Bury me not on the lone prairie.
Right.
Yeah. That speaks to the loneliness that a lot of cowboys felt. And that had to be the ultimate loneliness, to be buried alone, away from your family, out in the middle of nowhere.
And to be forgotten.
And to be forgotten.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. That's what that talks about.
Yeah. Because, you're out. And you're right. There are a lot of songs that talk about that. Guys that were killed in cattle stampedes and those type of things, you know.
So it's kind of about survival, too. I mean, it's not so much about the prairie.
Well, it's about, a lot of it is about the migration westward. Because a lot of the songs are about the pioneers and moving westward. That's where we took the name of our band. Was from the three trails that left Kansas City on their way westward, the Santa Fe, the California, and the Oregon trails. And speaking of being left
because
alone...
Because those are people who want to eventually end up not in the prairie anymore then. They want to end up on the West Coast.
They wanted to be in a better place. And
so funny, because I have sarcastically made the joke that our three trails that meet in Kansas City, like, they're evidence of how badly people wanted to leave here. And unfortunately, it sounds like you're telling me that's true.
Well, no, not really, because it was that frontier. Nobody really knew what was there. I mean, you could get to California by, you know, going around South America and coming up the West Coast. But the area of land really starting around Kansas City and going west was until Lewis and Clark mapped a great portion of that. Nobody really knew for sure what was out there. And you had a lot of the Indian nations, the Kaw Indians, which were dominant in that part of the prairie. But, you know, it stands to mention that a lot of those pioneers never went beyond Kansas or Oklahoma or Colorado, because along the way they found a place that they wanted to be. They found opportunities. A lot of them were German immigrants. They found out they could grow wheat, corn, soybean, and make a living out there. So, yeah, they all left maybe going someplace else, but a lot of people stopped along the way.
I want to hear a little more of your music because it's relevant to what we're talking about, to the prairie. We're going to hear a little snippet of a song that you have not released yet. It's called Song of the Prairie. I'm going to play a little bit of it, and then we'll talk about it, okay?
Sure.
Great.
All my life I've lived beneath the prairie sky, we're the best of friends, those hills and I. When I hear the drifting of the wind that sings a lonely prairie song, then I know that I'm where I belong. It goes, ooh, don't you hear the prairie call? Drift along, ever lonely prairie song.
You were making prairie wind noises with your voices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's our backup. We're singing in falsetto and putting those high, lonesome harmonies on the back of it.
Yeah, sort of almost a yodel, but not crossing there. That's a really beautiful song. At the Western Music Association convention last year, we met a gentleman named Cowboy Joe Babcock. And some of the listeners will know a song called I Wash My Hands in Dirty Water. And Cowboy Joe wrote that song. It was originally was made popular by Stonewall Jackson, but groups like the Grateful Dead, Elvis Presley, Marty Robbins, a whole bunch of people recorded that tune. And Joe took a liking to us, and he sent us a CD of songs he hadn't released yet.
And that was one of them.
And that was one he asked if we'd consider putting it on our album, and it is a beauty.
It's a beautiful song.
I don't mean to be obsessed with the prairie wind noise, but how did you develop the ability to create that really distinctive sound in song form, in vocal song form?
We call it woodshedding, and it's basically just doing it over and over again and being very, in a good way, critical of each other. Hey, you're a little sharp there. Lighten up a little bit. Don't push so hard.
But had you already heard in your heads what this was going to sound like and you just kept doing it until it happened?
Sure. Yeah.
And Joe had sent us a recording of it, so we knew what he had in mind. But we embellished on it and changed a few things, which we think he'll like. But that is... It's a part of Western singing. You'll hear that in a lot of different music. We do a song called Blue Prairie that has that. It's a real haunting tune.
Will you do a little prairie wind for us now?
Which part?
Blue
Prairie?
Blue Prairie.
Go ahead. You take
blue
lead.
Blue Prairie. Blue are the hills. Blue are the trills of the night bird calling. Every beating heart beats a rhythm that is true. And the moon has cast a blue reflection on the dew.
We don't have our lead singer.
So and then it goes on, and then it ends in a kind of yodel like that. You know, having said that, growing up in Western Kansas, the wind blowing is very much a part of our upbringing, because lying in bed at night, the wind blew all the time out there. And we lived in these old houses, and the wind would blow around in the eaves. It was part of your life, the wind blowing. And so it's just, the whole tumbling tumbleweed thing, those were winds blowing big old tumbleweeds across the prairie out there. So there's a lot of wind in cowboy music. It's spoken about quite a bit.
You tell me about the origin story of your band. I mean, I understand the origin story of how you two came to be singing together as young boys growing up as brothers, but how did this band form?
Yeah, it's been a few years in the making. I moved to Kansas City in the mid-80s, and we started a band called Total Strangers, and we did kind of electric bluegrass with drums. We were together for 10 years, and then we had a band that came out of that called Spontaneous Combustion, and we were together 21
seasons.
21
yeah.
seasons.
Same four guys.
And then one of our members moved away, and we started talking. We said, you know, we don't want to quit. And we said, we've always wanted to have a cowboy band. And so that's when this band started. And
it was a concept thing. We were coming back from our very last gig. We were way down in southwestern Kansas, and we had 6 hours to kill, and we were talking and decided to do this thing. And by
a long drive in Kansas. That seems like appropriate.
Oh, man. Well, we were about as far away from Kansas City as you could get where we were.
As we say, don't trail drive like my brother.
But by the time we got back to Kansas City.
Public radio cowboy joke.
We had already come up with the concept. We had already come up with the name for the band. And we'd even made a few phone calls and rounded up some players.
Little boys dress up like cowboys, and it fascinates me that you have become people who dress up as cowboys. Mm-hmm.
We dressed Western as kids too. If you see some of our first day pictures from school,
oh yeah,
Mom, we always had a fresh pair, a new pair of boots. We had nice snap shirts. We had nice jeans, and that's how we went to school.
What's it like to play dress up like this kind of, you know, at this stage in your life?
It's awesome. Great. It's really cool. I mean, it's just a lot of fun. You know, we take our clothes out and we kind of lay them out. Well, what scarf do you think I should wear with this shirt? You know, it's fun because when we get on stage, we just want it to be big, you know, and have a big show with it. So, yeah, getting dressed up is part. And we're kind of dressed down this morning. We don't have our spurs on.
Yeah, I left my chaps at home.
Leo and Roger Iltz of Three Trails West, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us. Thanks so much.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, the Big Red One in Fort Riley, Kansas. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. At the baggage claim at the Kansas City Airport, you might see signs orienting soldiers for Big Red One. What is that? Well, 100 years ago, the U.S. Army created a division called Big Red One. It's based out of Fort Riley, Kansas, and it's the longest continuously serving division in the U.S. Army. Today, as the division marks its centennial, we're going to hear about its legendary history from Robert Smith, who joins us from the 1st Infantry Division Museum. Hi, Robert.
Good morning.
What was going on 100 years ago when the U.S. Army started up the Big Red One in Fort Riley?
100 years ago, the division had arrived in France to assist our allies in our participation in the First World War. War was declared on April 6, 1917, and 1917 was not a good year for our British and French allies. So they wanted some sort of sign that America was really, really interested in, you know, participating in this war. Because we had sat it out for about 2.5 years. And so they needed a sign that America was interested in coming over and assisting them. And the Big Red One was formed in early June of 1917. And by July, it was arriving in France. And on July 14th, it participated in the Bastille Day Parade.
Wow.
With the 16th Infantry marching down the Champs-Élysées.
But so why was Kansas the location for this base?
Well, the Big Red One actually did not come to Kansas until 1955.
That makes more sense.
Yes. The Big Red One actually was created from active regular divisions that were down with General John J. Pershing on the Mexican-American border in 1916. And when President Wilson and Secretary of War Newton Baker decided to show our commitment, these units were pulled away from the Mexican border and immediately sent to France.
Why was it called Big Red One?
It was because of their patch. They were the first. Originally, little history here, it was originally titled in May and June when it was formed, the 1st Expeditionary Division, but then as America was gearing up for the war, that Expeditionary Division went away, and in June it was called the 1st Division. It was the 1st Division over, 1st Division created by the United States Army, and other divisions followed afterwards. But the Big Red One was first over, and they were called the Big Red One because of their patch and also the patch that the soldiers wore.
Does the history of this division matter to the soldiers who come through Fort Riley today?
Oh, very much so, very much so. The division has such a deep and rich history, and the history assists the esprit de corps of the unit. They can look back on their predecessors and see the deeds that they had done and the wars that they had participated in. The division has such a long, rich history, and it has an unusual history also. And I'll give you a little of those vignettes a little later on, because division has some really interesting history behind it. But the soldiers realized that their predecessors had accomplished some of these very heroic deeds. They were the first over in France in 1917. They were the first over in Europe during the Second World War. They landed on Normandy on D-Day on the 6th of June, 1944, marched across Europe. They were one of the first divisions to be in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam conflict. They were mobilized during Desert Storm and participated in Desert Storm. So they have a long, long history.
Does it in some way inspire or encourage soldiers today to feel continuity with those previous conflicts?
Oh, I think very much so. Very much so. They, as I said, they can look back and they know veterans that have served in these previous conflicts and have met with those veterans. We do a number of functions here at the museum where we pair veterans up, World War II Vietnam veterans, and they get to talk to them and bond, and they know that that lineage and that history of their division. So I think that's very applicable, that that they have this cognizance of the history of the division.
I understand that nicknames and like almost like kind of a coded language with slogans and sayings are a big part of the identity of this division.
Oh, sure. In World War One, the first soldiers over picked up the nickname, you know, Doughboys. In World War One, or in World War Two, the GI, government issue soldier, and then in Vietnam, they were called Grunts. And so they have their own own language and acronyms, both officially and unofficially.
What? Tell me how that fits into the culture there.
How that fits? I think it creates a sense of a bonding and a brotherhood. And you see this with a lot of veterans that come and visit the active duty soldiers, that they know the training they've gone through. They know the bonding in war, which is a really significant bond.
What about the slogans and sayings?
What about the slogans and sayings? The sayings, I think that's also that gives them sort of an identity, a specific identity.
Can you give some examples of those?
Oh, slogans of an identity. Oh, golly. I'm thinking that, you know, there's an entire language out there. A lot of it is probably can't be used on the air, but you know, and I'm hesitant really go into that.
Okay, fair enough. Some secrets are for insiders.
Some secrets are best kept.
But what's going on at Fort Riley today?
What's going on at Fort Riley today? Well, most of the division is returning from deployments all over the world. Just this month, the headquarters is returning from a deployment in Iraq. And things are not quiet here at Fort Riley, though. As soon as soldiers return from deployment, they begin their training for their next deployment.
Do you, you know, I guess, like, when we talk about the history of the different conflicts that people have been involved in, people who do their training and come and go from Fort Riley as part of the Big Red One, you know, war always has its critics. That's true today, and it has been during the conflicts of the past. Do you think that the relationship between the Army base and its surroundings ever does have political overtones, or does it somehow transcend politics?
I think it transcends politics. I think so, that there is a great relationship here in the Flint Hills region between the Army and the local citizens.
Tell me more about, you know, you said that you were going to tell us the little vignettes from the history. And
oh, there's some great stories. There's one particular story. There's actually two really interesting stories that come out of World War One. One is that the Big Red One actually has a wine, and the story is just it's rather humorous. Towards the end of World War One, these two young artillery officers had a truck full of ammunition, and they knew the war was coming to an end, and they came upon this destroyed farmhouse in France. And they started nosing around, and they looked down in the cellar, and they found cases and cases of wine. And so they unloaded the artillery shells, and they loaded the wine into the truck. And they started feeling a little guilty about taking all of this wine and especially unloading the artillery shells. So they went to their commanding officer, and the commanding officer said, well, what you did was, you know, not right. But we'll take it up to the division. And they took it up to the division, and the division commander at that time said, well, what you did is not right, but you better get rid of it. And so they found a way to get rid of all that wine that they had taken. But that wine is still available today, and it is Chateau Neuf du Pape.
Wait, and so it's available, like...
Commercially, it's available. But
so
it is also
from France?
I'm sorry, ma'am?
From France?
From France, but it's available in this country also.
But it's not like they have their own wine that they're making there in Fort Riley?
No. This is just the tradition that they've inherited.
The preferred wine of the division.
The preferred wine, yes, ma'am. And also, the 1st Infantry Division, and this comes out of the First World War also, is our division here is probably the only division that ever had a circus.
Go on.
And in 1919, when the division was on occupation duty in Germany at the end of the war, and we occupied portions of Germany from 1918 late 1919, the commanding general, General Summerall, decided that creating a circus would entertain the German populace and also the soldiers. With their rather, you know, mundane day-to-day duties. So they created a circus. They had lions, they had elephants, they had trained monkeys, and they had 34 clowns in the circus. And it was so popular in Germany that the circus was brought over to this country and toured the country in the early 1920s. And at the end of the performance, all the soldiers, by the way, the soldiers were the performers, but at the end of the performance, there was a mock tank battle with 10 tanks under the big top. And I think in my research, I believe that we are the only division that ever had the honor of having our own circus.
Well, that is quite a distinction. In your research also, I mean, as, I don't know, within any sort of community, there are usually lessons from the past. I mean, that's part of what those stories from the past kind of get passed along for. And I'm wondering if there are stories that are transmitted to all of the new soldiers about the past, stories that carry particular meaning or instruction.
We do that here at the museum. One of our missions here, being an Army museum, is we are an educator to the young soldiers that come through. And we tell them the story of their division, both the good and the bad. And we also try to put these little vignettes in, and as an instructor, I believe that they carry with those little vignettes, those little stories, long after the hard history has faded from memory.
So I know that you're probably a little reluctant to tell the bad over the radio, because to the soldiers, you know, that's instructive, and then to the public, that's maybe bad PR. But I am curious if there's a story that teaches a lesson that you could share with us.
Well, what I mean by the bad is the hardships of warfare, and by that, the vision. If I may tell you just a little story about Omaha Beach. They were the 1st Infantry Division was chosen to land at Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944. It was an incredibly hard fight. There were over 3,000 casualties, and we tell those stories, but we also interject, a little bit of humor. There's the story of Carl Wolf, who was a young lieutenant. And if I may, ma'am.
Oh, yes, please.
What he did is the morning of the landing at Omaha Beach. Omaha Beach was truly a horrific event for the division and for the American soldiers. I mean, it was unbelievable carnage. But Carl Wolf was a young lieutenant. The Navy had gratefully given all of the soldiers that were landing at Omaha Beach a large breakfast. And they gave him this breakfast at about 3 in the morning, and then they loaded him in landing crafts, which carried about 30 soldiers. And the waves were 6 to 8 feet high. It was an incredibly choppy day, and they kept him out away from the beach preparing for the landing for about 2 to 3 hours, so a lot of soldiers got very, very seasick. And this Carl Wolf was terribly seasick in this landing craft, and the soldiers next to him handed him a handful of pills and said, "Here, this will settle your stomach." Well, they happened to be Dramamine. Wolf was nervous about landing in combat, took the handful of pills, threw them in his mouth, swallowed them, landed on Omaha Beach with the assault, incredible carnage, a lot of suffering on the beach, and promptly fell asleep on the beach. And he woke up being tugged by another soldier, and he thought, "Oh, I'm supposed to be leading these men. What are they going to think about me falling asleep here when I should be commanding?" And then he thought about it for another minute, and he said, "Well, they probably thought I'm really cool, you know, that I can fall asleep under fire." But it was a terrible, terrible day on Omaha Beach. And the 16th Infantry Commander, Colonel George Taylor, actually walked up and down the beach. And this is the story that inspires the soldiers that we teach. And he said that there are two soldiers, types of soldiers on this beach. There are the dead and those that are about to die. So let's get the hell off this beach. And he actually inspired the soldiers to get off the beach and make a dent in the German lines. And that's what we try to impart here at Fort Riley when we teach our soldiers. We kind of tell the humorous, but we also throw in, you know, the inspiring.
Can you help me with this get off the beach thing? I mean, what is the bigger significance of that line? Because it sounds like a powerful line that someone could hear and maybe apply to another situation.
It's basically, get off the beach is that we're all dying here on the beach. If we don't, you know, make an impact here, make a significant attack, do not penetrate those German defenses, get up and face the bullets, that we will probably, you know, we will probably end up dying or not succeeding with our mission.
I have just one last question for you. I'm curious what it means to be the longest serving division. What happens to divisions that don't continuously serve?
They usually are demobilized and deactivated. And we have a number of divisions in the Army. During World War II, we had multiple divisions, 30, don't know the exact number, but today we only have 10 divisions, active divisions in the United States Army. And like I said, the Big Red One is the first and the longest serving.
Robert Smith with us from the 1st Infantry Division Museum. Thanks so much for sharing the history of the Big Red One in Fort Riley.
Oh, it's my pleasure, ma'am.
That's the oldest division of the U.S. Army, and it's celebrating its 100th birthday this year. Tomorrow, Johnson County used to have a place called a poor farm, where homeless people could live and grow food. We'll hear that history and the tradition it was part of tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope, with help from intern Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.